Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, this is my 50th show, coming up close to a year. What I'd like to start off today with is a case study on the coronavirus. This is a good example since infectious disease and vaccines as a response is central to a lot of progress we've made on disease prevention and control. As I said some weeks ago, I was predicting that the coronavirus epidemic would in fact break through and become widespread across the world. It's up to 25 plus countries now. It looks like there's some epicenters in very large areas, like for instance, Tehran, which is almost double the size of New York City. And it doesn't seem that with the number of deaths that's happened, that they're actually reporting the number of cases that would reflect that number of deaths, which means they're not probably right on top of it. And this is happening at multiple epicenters. This is not too surprising. A lot of people feared this. And I was looking anxiously, eagerly, to see if the grand social experiment of China with its authoritarian regime was able to do monumental containment, social isolation, and quarantine of entire cities. That type of effort has been by far the largest attempt to do that in human history, whether that would be able to contain the virus. And if it was, I'd be willing to give them props and say, you know what, that might actually be worth it. But I don't think that's the case. And as I'll talk a little bit later, that authoritarian approach is probably not a really good approach for public health in the long haul anyways. Well, this show, Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, intends to be your school of public health, the people's school of public health in the University of Life. So what's the next step with the coronavirus epidemic, and which is probably going to end up being a pandemic, meaning spread widespread throughout the planet? The death rates that they're reporting now are around 2%. That may be a slight overestimate, probably based on the fact that a lot of the cases, more mild cases, are probably not actually being counted or reported. But if you look at an epidemic that, say, sweeps the country or the world, where you have a large proportion of the human population exposed, you know, like a quarter or a third or a half of people exposed and getting at least some form of the coronavirus infection, even with a 1% mortality rate, you would be talking about tens of millions of deaths. So this isn't something to mess around with. It definitely is worthwhile to do mitigation and social isolation. But I'd like to talk a little bit about kind of what are the next stages, and really, again, use this as kind of a case study of kind of understanding public health, which is a long-haul effort. You don't just come in and police infectious diseases every once in a while and expect that you're going to win the long-term battle. So I want to start up first with just looking at a vaccine story, the coronavirus vaccine, this from Stat News. Sanofi announces it will work with Health and Human Services to develop a coronavirus vaccine. The drug maker Sanofi Pasteur is entering the race to develop a vaccine to protect against the new coronavirus sweeping through China, the company announced. David Low, Sanofi's global head of vaccines, said the company would partner with the U.S. Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, known as BARDA, to make a vaccine using the company's recombinant DNA platform. Lowe said the company's previous work to develop a vaccine for SARS, a cousin virus, gives it a leg up on this work. Even so, the work won't be quick. The timeline to a licensed vaccine, even with an emergency use approval, is likely 3 or 4 years, said John Shiver, Sanofi's head of vaccine research and development. That's probably about as fast as that can really happen. Sanofi expects to have a vaccine candidate to test in the lab within 6 months and could be ready to test a vaccine in people within a year to 18 months. Sanofi is the second major vaccine maker to announce that it will try to make a vaccine against the new virus. Smaller players in the vaccine world are already out of the gate with vaccine platforms, using DNA or messenger RNA that hold promise of speeding up the phase of development to a vaccine prototype with funding from the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation. But these companies are biotechs that do not have large-scale production facilities. Should their prototypes be successful, a producer with scalable manufacturing facilities would need to become involved. Mark Feinberg, president and CEO of the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, said it's important to have a variety of companies working on a vaccine for the virus, which causes a disease the World Health Organization has called COVID-19. I think you want to incentivize multiple manufacturers or developers to get involved because you don't ever know what's going to work and what's not going to work, and it's not appropriate to put all your hopes on one single vaccine. As Merck's former chief scientist, he was heavily involved in the company's acquisition and early development of an Ebola vaccine that was licensed in late 2019. Having a diversity of approaches and of programs, I think, is in general a good approach. Many major manufacturers have been slow to enter the effort to develop a COVID-19 vaccine. All the major producers have previous experience racing to develop vaccines amid outbreaks that never led to marketed products. Below said, when Sanofi saw that the coronavirus was continuing to spread, even despite the extraordinary containment measures imposed by the Chinese government, that really gave us pause. Okay, if you look at just the social isolation and quarantine, travel restrictions, shutting down business, people not going to work, all the costs of that economically, you were easily talking about hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. And I think one of the important public health lessons to look at is that prevention is very anonymous. And of course, prevention happens before a big outbreak happens. And I think the lesson that we should learn is that if we're willing, through other efforts, to put hundreds of billions of dollars of pay that price, then perhaps we should put at least a small proportion of that over time, in this case, into vaccine developments, not only for coronavirus, but vaccine development in general, to bolster the science that we have, to do it more effectively, and to do it more efficiently and more quickly, so if when we get novel new viruses like COVID-19, that we're able to respond quickly and effectively. And I would add, very cost-effectively, when you're given the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars price tag this is going to have, both economically, but obviously in a huge hit to human health on this planet. So let's go to a story related to that from Stat News. Lawmakers to Trump, don't give monopolies to companies that develop coronavirus treatments with taxpayer funds. Nearly 4 dozen lawmakers asked the White House to ensure any treatment for fast-moving coronavirus that is developed with U.S. taxpayer funds is reasonably priced, an issue that has previously emerged in connection with other nascent medicines due to angst over the cost of prescription drugs. In a letter sent by 46 members of Congress, they urged the Department of Health and Human Services not to issue an exclusive license to any drug maker that develops a coronavirus treatment over concerns that providing monopoly rights could result in an expensive medicine that is inaccessible, wasting public resources, and putting public health at risk in the U.S. and around the globe. Instead, they urged the Trump administration to issue limited licenses requiring companies to make any treatment available at an affordable price, although lawmakers did not offer an approach for how that might be established. They also insisted that HHS intervene if a drug maker prices a treatment for COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus, at a, quote, excessive price, which was not defined. The lawmakers pointed to a deal this month between the HHS Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, or BARDA, and Regeneron Pharmaceuticals to develop a treatment for the coronavirus. BARDA agreed to pay 80% of research and development and manufacturing costs after providing $8.9 million to support development of a treatment for Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS. There must be guardrails in place to prevent Regeneron from monopolizing the medicine and maximizing profits, they wrote in the letter, which was spearheaded by U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky, a Democrat from Illinois. We should not grant any manufacturer a blank check to monopolize a coronavirus vaccine or treatment developed with public taxpayer support. Without aggressive action to protect public health, we are fearful that Americans and people in lower and middle income countries will not be adequately protected against current and future coronavirus outbreaks. In arguing their case, the lawmakers pointed to a study released Thursday showing that the pharmaceutical industry had devoted little of its resources to developing a solve for the latest coronavirus disease. All six of the active coronavirus clinical trials that began prior to the outbreak received some form of taxpayer or public support, according to a report by Public Citizen. Since the emergence of SARS, or Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, 17 years ago, the National Institutes of Health has spent nearly $700 million on coronavirus R&D, the Consumer Advocacy Group wrote in its report. As of February 5th, there were at least 25 different vaccine and treatment efforts for COVID-19, and two-thirds have support from nonprofit and public institutions. Such concerns have increasingly emerged in recent years in connection with medicines that have been discovered with taxpayer funds. Why? Consumer advocates and lawmakers argue that public financing greases the wheels that make it possible for drug makers to further the research and, eventually, commercialize the discoveries. And in an era of rising drug prices, they maintain drug companies too often fail to acknowledge the role that taxpayer dollars play in drug discovery and later unfairly profit at taxpayer expense. The pharmaceutical industry has broadly claimed that the monopoly-based patent system is the most effective tool to reward and incentivize innovation and fulfills the promise of breakthrough in treatments and cures for scores of debilitating or life-threatening illnesses around the world, yet the monopoly model has not driven significant industry investment in infectious diseases, including coronaviruses, Public Citizen wrote in its report. So we shouldn't be paying twice for the same thing, and we shouldn't be doing the research for for-profit companies. They should be able to make a reasonable profit, but not price gouging us. And of course, the U.S. pays the most profit that's to be mined for pharmaceuticals of all sorts, including vaccines, is borne by U.S. consumers and taxpayers. Okay, now to talk about the complexity of, for instance, the initial massive effect of an authoritarian regime in China doing the social isolation and quarantine efforts, which are actually, you know, in the public health playbook to stop and slow disease. But like I said, this was a huge experiment in being able to, try to stop this coronavirus outbreak. But this is a good for this case study to really compare kind of what I would call a law enforcement model versus a public health model. The public health model is much more complex and requires broader changes in society and among citizenry rather than a centralized authoritarian or legalistic law enforcement kind of just make it happen through some kind of authoritarian dictates. So this story is from The Hill, and this is public trust in data could have helped China contain the coronavirus as an example of this principle. In less than 2 months, the coronavirus has spread from the Chinese city of Wuhan to 25 countries, prompting the World Health Organization to declare a global health emergency. In reaction, the Chinese Communist Party swiftly restricted travel and shut down major transportation systems, a feat that many believe possible due to the authoritarian control the government has over its citizens. While these efforts are aggressive and undemocratic, they fall within the scope of fairly well-known epidemic planning. However, many new data-driven techniques that could have stemmed or at least slowed the spread of the coronavirus has not been deployed. One reason for this is these methods rely on crowdsourcing data, which, to be accurate, often depends on public trust in the government's use of citizen information, something absent in China. For example, New York University professor Daniel Neal and MIT Lincoln Labs researcher Mallory Noble have developed a new tool called pre-syndromic surveillance that uses machine learning to comb through the de-identified emergency room and social media data to discover outbreaks that do not correspond with known illnesses. Recently, the team successfully piloted the technique in New York City's Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. Neil refers to the system as a public health safety net because by aggregating and analyzing the actual description of new symptoms from patients, first responders, and citizens, they are better able to identify and manage new disease patterns. Traditional epidemiologists rely on past cases and patterns to make public health decisions, but some new diseases behave differently. This technique allows us to identify and respond to something new. Similarly, tools like Flu Near You and Pandemic Pulse, developed by Boston Children's Hospital, integrate Twitter and Google search data to detect biothreats. Like Neil and Noble's pre-syndromic surveillance approach, these tools utilize natural language processing, engineering lingo that just means reading what people actually say or write down. Both teams won the Department of Homeland Security's 2018 Hidden Signals Challenge to use public data to identify emerging biothreats. But for any of this to work, citizens must trust these digital platforms won't be used to harm them. If a patient believes that if they tell an emergency room attendee or what they say on social media may lead to aggressive quarantines or other harmful actions by their government, it's less likely they will be honest. And without reliable, honest information, none of these new systems work. The New York Times reported that Chinese authorities went to great lengths to hide the disease from the public by silencing doctors and others for raising red flags and even closed a food market thought to be the source of the outbreak, but told residents it was due to renovations. While these activities surely slowed authorities' ability to work with citizens to respond to the disease, the new machine learning techniques outlined by Neil and others' work illuminates an even more important flaw in the Chinese strategy. The possibility that some new technologies may be democracy-oriented and that they simply work better in open societies. At a minimum, the demand for trust and transparency with citizen data represents an irony for the Chinese Communist Party. The government's expansive powers are often seen as scary but effective vehicles to monitor citizens, such as through new facial recognition technologies. But there's another way to look at it. If advances in crowdsourced citizen communication depend on accurate and complete information, which in turn relies on public trust, then places like China will struggle to fully take advantage of these technologies. The coronavirus spreads so quickly because it is a new virus that behaves differently than what we've seen before, and known methods of disease control were caught off guard. But new crowdsourced technologies can help us adapt quicker. Lack of public trust hurts those official efforts. Coronavirus is the latest global epidemic, but it won't be the last. The lack of greater trust and transparency from the government of the world's most populated country risks lives in China and across the globe. Okay, that's a very good example of something, about central control versus broader social change. And if you're looking at infectious diseases, there's a lot of things in society that really have to be centered around individuals, families, communities, that they have to themselves be able to play an active role in infectious disease spread mitigation. Like even just washing hands or avoiding public areas, basically self-quarantining completely or somewhat when you have symptoms or believe that you have a disease. Now, if you've got a society, for instance, where waitresses don't feel confident that they can afford to actually miss work and they go to work when they're sick, they're going to infect potentially multiples of people. So this is a weakness in broader society that cannot just be ordered by fiat to be changed. Now, obviously, you could have public policy or laws that could help, provide living wages and other social safety network type of things, so that waitresses is one example, but all kinds of workers, going into work when you're sick, when you really shouldn't be because of economic insecurity, this feeds back into a poor public health safety net, if you will, and the ability to contain or limit infectious disease outbreaks. Now, they just came out, like for instance with the flu, they just announced that it has a 45% effectiveness rate for the virus for this year. They do a different formulation every year to based on the mix of what they think are going to be the most prevalent flu virus strains that year. And of course, sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong, sometimes a new strain emerges, in the middle of the the epidemic or the flu season. And this is another reason why you need a good infrastructure of vaccine development, because it takes time, and you got to prepare and you have to do a lot of things ahead. But again, a lot of this comes back even to just working efforts that are more society-wide, and this is what public health, why public health, social justice, and equities within populations of all sorts needs to happen in order for public health to be robust, and we're supposed to have a healthy population. Okay, that's our case study for today. Now I simply want to go to our public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all the wonderful things in the world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research Roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
Okay, first up from WTTW.com. Study: no clear rationale for 45% of Medicaid antibiotic prescriptions. Millions of Medicaid patients are being prescribed antibiotics for no clear reason, according to a new study from Northwestern Medicine. The numbers suggest efforts to prevent the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria could be undermined by inappropriate prescribing practices, with potentially disastrous consequences for public health. The study, released earlier this month, found that 45% of all Medicaid prescriptions for antibiotics were made without any clear rationale. 17% of patients were given antibiotics despite there being no documentation of an infection-related diagnosis, and 28% of prescriptions were written without any evidence of a visit to a doctor. Right out of the gate, I would say that this isn't something that should never happen, but the degree to which it is happening is disturbing. It accounts for almost a third of all antibiotic prescriptions, said senior study author Dr. Jeffrey Linder, Chief of General Internal Medicine and Geriatrics in the Department of Medicine at Northwestern University School of Medicine. Most of them are probably for respiratory symptoms, and most of these respiratory symptoms are probably caused by viruses, but there is no documentation around these antibiotic prescriptions at all. The new study evaluated 298 million prescriptions filled by 53 million Medicaid patients between 2004 and 2013. Antibiotics are prescribed in the United States at a rate that is double that in many other countries. And each year, more than 2 million people in the U.S. are made sick, and some 23,000 die from infections caused by antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Indiscriminate use of antibiotics is increasing the prevalence of antibiotic-resistant bacteria and rendering them ineffective, said Linder. It's concerning that nearly half of antibiotics are prescribed without a visit or without a clear rationale. The World Health Organization says that rising antibiotic resistance is one of the biggest threats to global health, food security, and development. Antibiotics are used to treat bacterial infections and to prevent infection that could arise from many common surgeries, but overprescription as well as the use of antibiotics in livestock production has led to the rise of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Without urgent action, we are heading for a post-antibiotic era in which common infections and minor injuries once again can kill, according to a 2018 report from the World Health Organization. While there are some new antibiotics in development, none of them are expected to be effective against the most dangerous forms of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Antibiotic resistance is putting the achievements of modern medicine at risk. Linder agreed and said the public should be very concerned because the development of new antibiotics cannot keep pace with the evolution of so-called superbugs. All of modern medicine relies on the use of antibiotics. If you don't have antibiotics, you cannot do surgery. You cannot do organ transplantation. You cannot do chemotherapy. You need antibiotics to make these things work. And if we lose antibiotics, these miracles of modern medicine become infeasible. Okay, next up from Kaiser Health News. This is an interesting story about daylight savings time. Changing clocks is bad for your health, but which time to choose? Changing over to daylight saving time, a major annoyance for many people, may be on its way out as lawmakers cite public health as a prime reason to ditch the twice-yearly clock-setting ritual. The time change, especially in the spring, has been blamed for increases in heart attacks and traffic accidents as people adjust to a temporary sleep deficit. But as legislators across the country consider bills to end the clock shift, a big question looms ahead of this year's March 8th change, Which is better, summer hours or standard time? There's some strong opinions, as it turns out, and they are split, with scientists and politicians at odds. Retailers, chambers of commerce, and recreational industries have historically wanted the sunny evenings that allow more time to shop and play. Researchers on human biological rhythms come down squarely on the side of the standard wintertime hours, referred to as God's time by angry farmers who objected to daylight saving time when it was first widely adopted during World War I. What's not in question is that the clock switching is unpopular. Some 71% of people want to stop springing forward and falling back, according to a 2019 Associated Press and NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll. Politicians have reacted accordingly. More than 200 state bills have been filed since 2015 to either keep summer hours or go to permanent standard time, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. The measures getting the most traction right now are for permanent daylight savings time, which makes more sun available for after-work activities. But none of these efforts can become reality without the blessing of Congress. States have always been able to opt out of summer hours and adopt standard time permanently, as Arizona and Hawaii have done, but making daylight savings time year-round is another story. A German study of autopsies from 2016 to 2015, for instance, showed a significant uptick just after the spring switch in deaths caused by cardiac disease, traffic accidents, and suicides. Researchers have also noted significant increased risk for heart attacks and strokes. The human clock was not built to jump back and forth. That's why we get jet lag. It is very easy to show that if you knock people off an hour of sleep, there's a bump temporarily and bad things that will happen. All of this alarms scientists who study human biological rhythms. Researchers in the U.S. and the European Union have taken strong positions about permanent summer hours. The Society for Research on Biological Rhythms posts its opposition prominently on the top of its website. Messing with the body's relationship to the sun can negatively affect not only sleep, but also cardiac function, weight, and cancer risk, the Society's members wrote. According to one oft-quoted study on different health outcomes within the same time zones, each 20 minutes of later sunrise corresponded to an increase in certain cancers by 4 to 12%. The AP poll found 40% of its respondents support permanent standard time, with 31% opting for permanent daylight savings time. People have gotten comfortable with daylight savings time since its duration has been lengthened by 8 months by extensions in 1986 and 2007. Before 1986, daylight savings time lasted 6 hours. So now, really most of the year, we are on the summer schedule, and people are used to that, and they like it. That makes them more aggrieved when we go back to the winter schedule. In any case, changing the clocks is a rare issue in that it isn't partisan. If the government can't respond to people when they want something and it's not even a partisan issue, that's just a sad commentary. Can't we please fix something that doesn't make sense anymore? Okay, my shortest story ever. This from Modern Healthcare. Publicly traded health insurers' revenues nears $1 trillion mark. The largest publicly traded health insurers grew profits by a combined 66% in 2019, driven by massive mergers and acquisitions. So if anybody thinks that the high price of healthcare is not driving and driven by huge profits of for-profit drug companies, think again. Okay, next up, this from Vox.com. 1 in 4 rural hospitals is vulnerable to closure, a new report finds. 2019 saw a record number of rural hospitals close because of poor financial performance, a sign of a deepening crisis. The financial crisis for America's rural hospitals is getting worse. A new report from the Chartis Center for Rural Health puts the situation in dire terms. 2019 was the worst year for rural hospital closures this decade, with 19 hospitals in rural America shutting their doors. Nearly 1 out of every 4 open rural hospitals has early warning signs that indicate they are also at risk for closing in the near future. Since 2010, 120 rural hospitals have closed, according to University of North Carolina researchers. And today, 453 of 1,844 rural hospitals still operating across the country should be considered vulnerable for closure. The Chartis researchers sought to identify key risk factors that precipitated rural hospital closures and then use those criteria to project which hospitals are at risk of closing soon. Some of the criteria was obvious, like changes in revenue or how many beds are occupied on average. But there was one other leading indicator that has an obvious political explanation and which should be entirely avoidable, whether the hospital is in a state that expanded Medicaid under Obamacare. According to Chartists, being in a Medicaid expansion state decreased by 62% the likelihood of a rural hospital closing. Conversely, being in a non-expansion state makes it more likely a rural hospital will close. The states that have experienced the most rural hospital closures over the last 10 years, Texas, Tennessee, Oklahoma, Georgia, Alabama, and Missouri, have all refused to expand Medicaid through the 2010 health care law. It seems their rural hospitals are paying the price. Of the 216 hospitals that Chartist says are most vulnerable to closure, 75% are in non-expansion states. These 216 hospitals have an operating margin of -8.6%. Studies demonstrate that Medicaid expansion has significantly improved hospital operating margins and financial performance. A study published in January 2018 found that Medicaid expansion was associated with improved hospital financial performance and significant reductions in the probability of hospital closure, especially in rural areas and areas with higher pre-Affordable Care Act uninsured rates. Another analysis found that expansion's effects on margins were strongest for small hospitals, for-profit and non-federal government-operated hospitals, and hospitals located in non-metropolitan areas, or rural hospitals. The third study found larger expansion-related improvements in operating margins for public compared to non-profit or for-profit hospitals, and rural compared to non-rural hospitals. As you can see, the consistent conclusion is that Medicaid expansion is particularly helpful for rural hospitals, and yet a state like Texas, where more than half of its rural hospitals are vulnerable to closure, still refuses to accept the generous federal funding that covers 90% of the cost for Medicaid expansion. States had a choice about expanding Medicaid, and so far, 14 states have rejected the offer. They've left 2.3 million people uninsured, and they are putting the future of our rural hospitals at risk. The fact that rural hospitals are becoming endangered is yet one more reason why a single-payer, coherent, rational system is useful and helpful. Let's make it happen.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.